living skills, commenced to train us. He said, paddle like hell to live. Right, we said, we gotcha. On a raft with missionary-looking elder folks and this tall, blonde, skinny assistant, we got about half mile down the gorge when our boy said, that guy's in the water. What? I said, who? Oh, the guy who's steering this thing. He fell out at Devil's Rapids. Well, when he got to the boulders we were stuck between, he warned us severely. Anyone falls out, don't hang on. Most likely that'll hurt him more, and it could kill him. Smash him on a rock or something. Just let him float and catch up with the raft. Oh, God, this was way too much adventure. This going down Class 6 Rapids, we learned later, that means, sucker, do it only if you're prepared to meet your maker. But we were hell-bent for adventure. I was finding reserves of skill in myself. The speeches made a strong impression. When our little girl fell out and boy hung on, the precise, exact opposite to our instructions. Long story short, we saved her. Kind of adventure seemed exciting later, but at the time was scary. And also, I forgot to mention, in case you're not familiar with the general area, we were in deliverance country. In our own book movie with children, a certified lifesaver, two preachers, and beside us in a kayak, going backwards down Devil's Drop just to see if they could, Wahoo and his girlfriend Pretty. If they could have taken away our parents' licenses, that would have been the day to do it. Though to our credit, we were only giving an adventure to the kids to remember, and Jesus, I was paddling hard and steady. I wasn't losing a bit of concentration. Well, finally, it was lunch on a rocky beachhead. White bread and peanut butter, cherry Kool-Aid. I think I remember clearly Wahoo didn't expend too much on the hand-packed lunches. And the preachers, two water-soaked, increasingly silent geezers, were looking older and tireder. And the afternoon's mostly a blur. Names all started with devil is what I remember of the rills and the rapids and the whirlpools and the goddamn waterfalls, devil's turbulence. Devil's own road a hoe, devil's water get you if you stop paddling. And I didn't. I was intent on this adventure. And the sun was going down early when we landed at last in Tennessee. Quiet country town, white frame porches, picket fences, a regular dream of a safe place, but at the 7-Eleven, stocking up on fare for the bus ride back, Wahoo started in on a story. This town's where, in 1910, they hung an elephant. Yes, sir, I shit you not. Poor thing sat on a kid. Mistake, of course, but folks in this town are crazy. Had a trial and found him guilty. Couldn't find a tree big enough. Brought in a crane and did it. This town is little, but it's famous, and they don't cotton to outsiders. Best if we be gone by dark. Well, we stopped just once for what was left of our adventure. Another roadside entrepreneur. This one selling pornographic houseplants. Little men with cactus cocks. I bought one and asked about tax on the thing. Fellow selling said, I don't truck with taxes. He wore overalls, wore a cap that said, who gives a shit, which I did, plenty, let me tell you. That whole adventure with my man and my kids and Pretty, the state-licensed trained lifesaver, two preachers, and of course Wahoo, I was paying mine to paddle. Okay, that's the end of Wahoo. That's so far my only epic. The next poem I wrote when I was in Connecticut, it was provoked by a New York Times article, actually, about bison in Yellowstone Park and how the Interior Department was going to allow shooting of them if they stepped outside an invisible boundary. But eventually the poem came to be more about all the ways we're divided and all the ways we lose each other from moving, especially. I'm very conscious of it because I've moved so many times. It's called My America That Divides. I once had campfires with my friend now gone to Colorado. Small campfires. Small mountains here in the east were all we had to offer. She left for wilder parts. Claudia can see Pikes Peak from her window, and it's true. Not a half mile from her house, some shaggy hills still shelter the coyote. It's almost wild there. Here, some yellow leaves lie pressing the old grass. Mostly, leaves don't fall in Colorado. Claudia looks through ponderosa pine and hip-deep snow all winter, starting early, staying late. I don't know what calls are there, or whether she can remember that train sound coming out of the Black Rock face in West Virginia, Harper's Ferry. We camped there with our men and kids. I love that place where the Potomac, that fast, hard river, and the muddy, wide, slow Shenandoah join. In wildness, it's the best we have to offer. Now some years have gone, and on her part of the continent, experts plot a hunt so bison will not stray to the stranger, richer grasses out of range where they're allowed. On my part, rain her land could use comes lightly down. The next poem, I'm going to have to restrain myself from a story longer than the poem because it's one of those that I don't know how much you need to say. That's called Polly Wadley Haysmith Calling. It's the name of a woman whose maiden name was Wadley, which was mine also, who then married a man named P.L. Hayes, this rich guy in Macon, Georgia, and then in middle age married this coach named Catfish Smith. And I had heard all this when I was a kid, but I didn't remember it. And then in the 90s, my husband and I went to Macon on a root-seeking trip, and a woman whose name, I swear to God, was Dixie, refreshed all this for me at the place called the Hay Mansion in Macon, which we just happened into. We didn't even know where we were. So anyway, I got in touch with her. She was my father's first cousin. She was a woman in her late 80s then. And we started a correspondence. And she gave me a kind of positive view of my family, which was a new experience. Okay, Polly Wadley, Haysmith Calling. Polly lived in style. Summer in La Jolla, winter in Hawaii, long ways from Macon, Georgia, where she said the heat got to her. Catfish Smith, the legendary football coach, jilted Polly in youth, then married her in middle age. He might have been a bottom feeder, or king of the Amalgi, that muddy water runs through Macon, or something in between. I just don't know. Don't know a thing about the Hays of the Hay Mansion either. These matters are distant and dim, and Polly died last year. A few days before, she wrote me a letter, mostly about love and pride. She said my daddy had been handsome and fine and that she was proud of us and wished she could be with us all someday. Who like her came out of the deep red clay along the Amalgi and grew tough-bottomed feet going barefoot most of the year. We had a phone wall unlikely to be painted this lifetime. So the question came, why not write on it? I can hear Polly answer wadly. The A that sounds like ah, and the ending the lay in love or down to sleep, with the ease of respect and the history we bear behind us. I can hear her calling what spreads out over all of us, rich or poor, famous or not, traveled or stay at home, our family name. The next poem has many rivers in it. I hate to admit this, but I love to watch the Weather Channel, which caused one of my nieces to say, Aunt Suzanne, you need to get a life. But I'm fascinated by weather and climate, and I was noticing when we lived in Virginia, we moved here from Richmond, Virginia, that a lot of the weather would sort of start southwest of us around Alabama and kind of swoop up. And so for some reason, it seemed important what rivers it had crossed and such. So this too segs into the poem, so I won't say the title separate. When that sweet wind through my southern window comes, I like to trace where it's been. The half-moon curve of sweep begun just west into Alabama, I imagine, and come across some low-slung parts of Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas. To reach Virginia, it's crossed the Chattahoochee, the Suwannee, the Savannah, gone over the Cape Fear River and the Tar, and passed close by here, our river linked forever to lost causes and surrender, Appomattox. I guess it's blown dangerous and lovely in gusts and wisp across Confederate dead and kudzu and moonbines, and long-distance rigs hauling computer junk so we can have more of nothing faster, and military installations we'd rather not know about, and malls, and the mud still, and the lightning bugs. The whole shebang, really. All the mess. The chickens murdered for our delight. The hogs butchered on our behalf. Jesus, there's no end to the eating. So, like I say, when that sweet wind comes up and strokes the drift of my aging jawline and causes the bedclothes to rise just for a moment with the added ghosts, well, it's just gentle and cool and consoling as the child I'd like to believe I once was in the time I'd like to believe I once had. Thank you. In this poem, the names refer to my siblings plus rock and roll people. It's called Jitterbugging the Bottom. We pull back the big claw-footed round oak table, the one years later Peggy and Catherine fought over, ruining one complete Christmas, only to mean Catherine took that thing and put it in her basement in Atlanta, let it get stained and warped, then sold it out of the family. But that night we still had it and we moved it. The chairs pushed back, we were ready. Fats, Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bo Diddley, Elvis Presley, all the absolute best we had on 45s, in a pink and black carrying case made expressly for taking your music to parties. We could dance. I mean, we could dance. And the house was just full of Bill's buddies. big, sexy young guys crazy to boogie, and Lord, we did. So hard, we shook the plumbing pipes loose from the house. Our house was built on short stilts, on a bedrock of sand, with a network of springs under that. If you'd gone down under it far enough, you could have swum from Tampa clear to Crystal River and come up and found yourself looking smack dab in the faces of manatees, which, friends of the earth, excuse me, do not in any way look like mermaids or mysterious sirens of the sea. In fact, up close, they look like blobs. You can't tell their ends from their beginnings. So in a house where anger got mopped up with mad, one June night in 55, we shook the pipes loose. And this is how stories get started. We fill up with magic and beauty what we won't otherwise preserve. Thank you. I'd like to read three poems from my last chapbook, which is called The Shine on Loss. The first one came about when I went to, this again was in Connecticut. I know I'm skipping all around these places. I came to a party and I sat down next to a woman, and almost instantly she started telling me this story of how her husband had died in a small plane over Long Island Sound, and that there was never any trace found. They never knew what happened. He just started home and was never heard from again. Her grief was so intense and so palpable that I assumed this had just happened, you know, fairly recent past. I found out only later that it had been 17 years before. Clearly this was, had become the one story of this woman's life. And about a year later, I was at the same house and heard her daughter giving a version of the story. And I was struck by how different the daughter's version was. It was much more complicated than just grief when the daughter told the story. So this is called Heard When Her Daughter Told the Story. The sound, again, is Long Island Sound. I think that's pretty clear. A piper is a Piper Cherokee plane, although it's hopefully more suggestive here. Across the sound, in tandem with a piper, toward home from Mystic, he was flying his first solo, and at night, in snow. I don't think he did that fall they do in movies, when from a handsome formation one plane banks off to the left, then another, another, though he was capable of it. He could fly. If he followed his left wing, it was not from loving the flashiness and flair of the act, and the moment wasn't revelatory, full of anything so nameful as angels or as dread. He wasn't escaping or making a point of failing. He didn't mean to die without an ending, no mayday, never a word. If he banked on his nether side toward his diminutive, ice-covered wing, it was because alone in a small plane in a snowstorm over the Atlantic, he was trying to find his way. Another shift of locale now to Florida, which is where I was born, and to a Georgia family, but I mostly grew up in Florida, some in Georgia, but mostly in Florida. This is called The Difference Between Me and Bill. Before he became a part of what is meant by going belly up, back when he still wore suits and sold business forms all over Hillsborough County, hell, all over Florida, he'd say then. He'd often grab a bite to eat at a small luncheonette on Tampa Street, sit near the plate glass window, and watch the demolition going on. One day, the crane drops a girder and it neat slices off the back of a man's head, just like salami, he tells me, and he's the first and only one to see it happen. He feels it isn't exactly fair for him to have to see it, and it's only the beginning of a long line of things he'll have to witness, though he doesn't leave the county, and though his friends go on to become magistrates, politicos, simple kinds of moochers, while he goes belly up and watches his family fall away. And I come to feel it isn't fair either. It's not like my demolition. In my demolition, there's a house behind me just filled with a trashy crowd. Then the women and the children leave, and only a drunk guy and his buddies are left. The heat and lights have long since been killed, so they tear off the mantle and the inner stairs and burn them. They bring dogs to the house. The dogs get mange, and the guy and his buddy start to puke in broad daylight. Then the house is condemned. The drunks are forced to move, and the city hires a crew to wreck the place. It is a loud, graceful demolition, but somehow over quick. The walls of the three stories collapse against themselves while sights as embarrassing as bathtubs, as intimate as kitchen curtains, come into everyone's view. The last push before the final fall produces, high above the heap of what will soon be rubble, an entirely alive, very fat raccoon sitting on the back of a scarlet wing chair. And it is surprised and annoyed, but not afraid. The raccoon escapes in time, and clearly she is a mama raccoon. And that night, there is a moon over what is now a field. The next poem is a short one that I want to read for my friend Mary Ann here, and I'm sure many others in the audience who are step-parents. It's strange how little poetry there is about it. It's one of the most common experiences going on today, but there doesn't seem to be much written about it. This is just called Stepmother. Never has my boy child let me be the sun. Never let me be the earth. I'm the millstone for his childhood century. He runs through the carnival, leaving me a shill for a family show he didn't buy a ticket to. Nights our old dog falls, though, and we must help him. Me and my half-grown son. Sometimes my boy child lets me be the moon, lets his face collapse in the moonlight. Okay. The last poem I want to read is said in my first and only Quaker meeting, the first and only one I ever attended. I had a problem with a Quaker meeting, you know, no music, no liturgy, no ideas, no sermon, no community. It was very strange to me, and I sort of kept myself distracted by watching this dog that was in the middle of this circle. It was in a home, a private home, and everybody sat in a circle, and the owner's dog was right in the middle, and for me, that was the best part of it. So this is called At Quaker Meeting, The Spirit Dog. A big black dog lay in the middle of the silent circle of friends, gave a few baleful thumps of his tail, loudly sighed, and settled back into a boredom ever so profound. I loved that dog that day. He made me want to laugh out loud that all our assemblage of lawyers and administrators and other purveyors of a world we tried to love and question both, all goodwill, Volvos, and bean sprouts, were waiting in silence for the spirit. It seemed nothing like the spirit would move in a city living room with hay rakes on the walls for ornament, a room just beige to its core, though we were sincere and earnest people, repudiating knit toilet paper holders and vinyl covers over couches lasting a whole lifetime's marriage and beyond, and our parents' more talky religions. One woman spoke once, something about discovering herself. It didn't seem like the spirit. Then a fellow, not trying to make big a little thought he had, said, "That dog right in the middle of us here is beautiful. I love that dog." He lit up with his saying the shiny coat and curling tail and floppy iridescent ears of the dog, who raised his head in that open, goony way a dog hoping for a romp will do. And a plain, awkward woman in a business suit grabbed the platter of pastries, pale almond crescents for the after-meeting coffee, took off her high heels, ran with the dog out the door and all the way down the long driveway for the leaping, eating, hugely happy big black dog hung those moons in the daylight sky. Thank you.
Thank you, Suzanne. We're going to take just a few minute breaks and we'll come back with a second set of more music and Jim Bogan. Thanks.